This episode is brought to you by AlphaSense, the AI platform behind the world's biggest investment decisions. The right financial intelligence platform can make or break your quarter. AlphaSense is the number one rated financial research solution by G2. With AI search technology and a library of premium content, you can stay ahead of key macroeconomic trends and accelerate your investment research efforts. AI capabilities like smart synonyms and sentiment analysis provide even deeper industry and company analysis. AlphaSense gives you the tools you need to provide better analysis for you and your clients. As yet another Value Podcast listener, visit alpha-sense.com/FS today to beat FOMO and move faster than the market. That's alpha-sense.com/FS.
All right, hello and welcome to yet another Value Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Walker. If you like this podcast, it would mean a lot if you could rate, subscribe, review it wherever you watch or listen to it. With me today, I'm happy to have on for the final podcast of the year, my friend and the founder of Ringy Capital, Chris DeMuth. Chris, how's it going?
I thought you were going to say final podcast with Chris DeMuth. He's getting fired right on air.
No, actually,
we're done with him.
I'm typing with one hand right now, and I almost said, when I was tweeting this out, I almost said the final podcast with Chris DeMuth, and I was like, oh man, between Chris's health and my health, people are going to be thinking we're talking about way different things for this podcast. Yeah. But look, we're taping, it is Thursday, December 28th. We're taping our final podcast of the year. I'll just start the way I do every podcast. Quick disclaimer, remind everyone, nothing on this podcast is investing advice. Always true, but particularly true today because Chris and I don't even know what we're going to talk about. I had surgery 48 hours ago. We could get real loopy in here, but we're going to talk about a lot of different things. So please remember, nothing we say is investing advice. Please consult a financial advisor. Do your own work. Again, Chris, it is Thursday, December 28th. We're coming up on year end. What's on your mind right now?
Glad we're both alive, and glad, good to see you, and I don't want to be too redundant with last time we spoke, but I'm certainly thinking about a lot of litigation. I feel like I've been reading a lot of lawyerly long documents between merger arbitrage and litigation and other litigations that we're looking at. So that's been a big part of my life this past month. Biotech coming alive, banks and thrifts coming alive, kind of a lot of interesting things in the market there. But yeah, so I'd say merger arb litigation.
Let me just go through some of the things I threw out on Twitter. Hey, anything you want me to ask Chris? And people threw out a ton of stuff that regulatory reasons we can't talk about, for strategic reasons we can't talk about. But I do want to hit a few questions people ask. Let me start with Roivant. So Roivant's been really interesting. I know you focused a lot on it recently. This is a company, I don't even want to go into through the full background, but it's up, it's down, it's crazy. I mean, it trades for kind of net cash. And I just want to ask, you know, the ticker there is ROIV for people who don't know. But what's going on with Roivant these days? And as you kind of look into 2024, what do you see the path for them?
It is an interesting structure. So Roivant is in Roy, like the king of the Vants. The Vants are their kind of public, in some cases private, in some cases subsidiaries that they kind of spin or kind of cultivate. And some are flops and some are successes. Kind of the bonanza success so far has been Immunovant, ticker IMVT. That's one that looks like it is kind of a fully kind of developed for the public market. Reasonably likely that they sell that this next year. At least it's kind of gone through the whole cycle of Roivant's effort cultivating. Another one, it is close. I'm a shareholder of Roivant. Another of their public subs is Arbutus, ticker ABUS, also own that separately and distinctly from the Roivant exposure. So that has been less dramatically successful so far and earlier in its life process. And then they have, I mean, the org chart looks like a kind of Rube Goldberg machine of overlapping interest of who owns what. And then another private subsidiary. But the cash is interesting, especially net of Immunovant. If that's sold this year, I mean, they'll just be flush. It's trading as if it's worthless, but they have, you know, some history of being able to cultivate these. What's by far and away the most interesting to me, and sometimes whole reports are written not even mentioning it, is that there is a litigation against Pfizer and Moderna. During the early part of the COVID response, the government was very clear, move fast and break things. And boy, did these companies ever, in terms of some of the slowest and most bureaucratic processes were set aside to kind of rush a vaccine to market. And in the moving fast and breaking things, one of the things they broke was intellectual property that they had spent time trying to buy, trying to license, and then they kind of gave up and they just took it. And in this case, I think there is extremely valuable a litigation against both Moderna and Pfizer. What's interesting to me is whoever settles first, whoever ends up with probably a royalty relationship with these different Raven companies, will have this huge intellectual property value against each other. So, you know, Moderna and Pfizer looking at each other with, you know, their own IP. They're huge companies. And Arbutus is tiny. I mean, Arbutus is a $400 million company. Pfizer today is a $162 billion company. Moderna is not that big, but it's a $38 billion company. A sliver of royalty, you know, my guess is a day that Arbutus doubles or triples, Moderna and Pfizer wouldn't even necessarily be down. Like, it's just kind of an odd lot for them, but it's super valuable in terms of their intellectual property portfolio against each other and kind of at their scale. So it's kind of like if there was a world war, or a potential world war, it's like having this little tiny ally that might not be that valuable in and of themselves, but it has like this key strategic, I'm trying to think of a risk analogy, but like it's the key strategic.
Like in Risk, the board game, it's, you know, if you've ever played, everybody always tries to conquer Australia, right? Because you get Australia and it's because it's got that one land bridge and you get that and you can get a protected position and move out. And it would be that one land bridge, right? Like in the grand scheme of the whole board, it's nothing, but it's like the most critical. It's the most critical strategic place. Let me ask you, so we're about so interesting because they come public through a SPAC. They've got all these different stuff. And I think
Siam. Once you control Siam, then there's no other way to get to Australia.
Is that what it is? Okay. Yeah. So we're about so interesting because it comes public through a SPAC. The stock, you know, with all the SPACs goes straight down. And I think the two things that are interesting is these guys have exhibited, I would say, on some regards, incredible capital allocation. And I mean this, I can't remember what the drug's name, but they buy a derma drug for like basically nothing from Pfizer a year ago. And then they turn around and sell it for $6 billion or so, if I remember correctly. I'm doing this off the top of my head earlier this year. It was Vadim. Wait, do you remember which drug it was? It was Vadim, wasn't it? Yeah.
And it was basically more or less given. I mean,
yes.
which looks to... investigative journalist really do something there in terms of understanding exactly how that came about. But that looks to me almost related in some ways to the machinations around the liability and litigation and IP. It was very interesting why Pfizer would have done that, other than just the scale mismatch where it was very valuable to the one side and not that much to the other. But still, that was a curious...
I hear you on skill mishmash, but so it was Televant, and they sell it for $7.1 billion. I don't think they get quite all of that $7.1 billion, but you know, I hear you on skill mishmash, but there aren't many companies where $7.1 billion is a full rounding error as them. Like, I'm sure Pfizer would have been like, oh, if we could have sold this for $7.1 billion instead of zero, we would have taken it. But I guess we should just, so they do that. Immunovant's been an absolute home run. They've got these other things that have been just great home runs. So that's on one side, but on the other side, it goes public through a SPAC. The stock goes from, you know, every spec starts at 10, it goes from 10 to 3 as everything gets killed. And then they start issuing equity like kind of like crazy, right? Like I think they did secondaries this year, and some of it was SoftBank selling it, but some of it was them getting pricing. Like at the beginning of this year, they did one at $7.50 per share. And they're kind of doing these at, they've got literally billions in cash on the balance sheet. They're trading for net cash. So I guess the confusing thing to me about Roivant has been, on the one side, you've got these guys who are making these great investments, these great capital allocation decisions, investments in pharma. And on the other side, they're like diluting almost like crazy at cash value. And I've had trouble like kind of squaring the two, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. So Immunovant is the sixth most successful de-SPACed equity in the history of the SPAC market. Not a lot of competition recently, but I mean, it really was a spectacular in a class that is largely down pretty horrifically in the last few years. Boy, there are some big holders. So specifically, SoftBank was really bailed out by the enthusiasm around AI and a couple of things where they were close to getting a lot of trouble, and then they end up with some kind of enthusiasm in parts of their portfolio that made it less necessary for them to kind of fire sale things like Roivant. Like they were close to needing to just like puke it and then didn't. Sumitomo can sell by February, and there'll probably be a secondary for that. If Vivek is elected president, or less improbably put in the cabinet, he would have to do a secondary to sell the rest of his Roivant. So there are other big blocks that's kind of been an overhang. So maybe the market perception part of it might be that. But yeah, no, they're quirky. I mean, the senior people, certainly Vivek and other people early on, were really more kind of finance and hedge fund guys than medical guys. But then in their subsidiaries, they're very much medical guys with very, very little kind of financial focus, generally, you know, at the market, secondaries, and just kind of like they want to continue on plugging away with their research with very little kind of per share value focus. So yeah, no, it's quirky. Some of it seems good, some of it seems bad, but the net of it is that it trades what I think is super cheap.
And now a quick break to remind you that this episode is brought to you exclusively by AlphaSense, the AI platform behind the world's biggest investment decisions. AlphaSense gives you the tools you need to provide better analysis for you and your clients. As yet another Value Podcast listener, visit alpha-sense.com/FS today to beat FOMO and move faster than the market. That's alpha-sense.com/FS.
Yeah, it's just, I'm just looking at the history, like, no, this is November 2022. Huge secondary. Roivant sells 20 million. SoftBank sells 10 million, and that was at $5 per share. And at the time, I think a lot of people were like, "Hey, you know, Immuvant plus cash is worth more than that." So you're getting all the rest of the Vants for completely free, which they're arguing are valuable. And you know, they're doing the secondary here. They do another one earlier this year. Like, it's just been weird because it's like, hey, they're having all the success, and Immunovant has been huge. And Roivant does, Immunovant does, on the heels of having this great result with their drug, Immunovant does a secondary, which actually makes sense, right? That's a pre-cash, one drug, revenue burn, cash burning company. They do a secondary when their stock moonrockets after they have great results. And Roivant does a secondary to fund putting money into the Immunovant secondary. So it was just like, hey, I get it. But at the same time, you're trading for less than the cash in the stock, and you're putting more money into Immunovant, and you're doing these second. It was just a weird, it's just been a little weird, I guess. It's a little funky to me.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I like them. I certainly like participating in them. And they've worked to this point well so far, but still just not nearly as well as it should. You know, it'll be interesting to see if the market, you know, we got through the Telavant sale earlier this month, a few weeks ago. And then if we get the Immunovant sale, I mean, the market will just have to start giving credit for this, I'd think, if it's a pile of cash plus very promising litigation.
You think they sell Immunovant instead of, because I've heard some people be like, do they sell it or do they take it in? You think they sell Immunovant?
I think sell it. Okay. I think so.
But let's switch to, well, I guess we might as well. Somebody said Save is the new ATVI. So, of course, we need to talk about that. Obviously, I did the wrap-up pod with Lionel and with MDC. But I guess let's quickly get your thoughts on Save, as, you know, it's possible we get a ruling before this podcast even goes live. But as we sit here, December 28th, how are you feeling about Spirit these days?
Very sensitive to try to not think about this by analogy or, like, you know, if A, then B. If A, then A, and if B, then B. And we can't extrapolate too much from kind of single-digit numbers of relevant recent precedents. It's a different judge, different facts, different situation. And so I try not to strain the analogies too much. ATVI worked. I expect Save is going to work. But they're very, very different situations in a lot of ways. And I'm far more humble about Save than ATVI. ATVI's antitrust issues were a joke. I think Spectrum Brands' antitrust issues were a joke. Antitrust issues in this industry are serious. I think the Northeast Alliance decision was probably right on balance in a lot of ways. And so I think this case is not a great theory, but it's a plausible theory. I think it was disappointing from the regulatory enforcement, kind of good government, good public policy perspective on how little they felt they needed to argue for and provide evidence for their theory. They seem very comfortable and confident asserting. And if they win this, if it's just a blowout win for the government, if the judge basically endorses the government's view, then I think that will further embolden them with this idea on a gross basis without any serious effort at the materiality. If there is a nominal price increase as a result of the deal anywhere in any increment, well, we can block this. I think they're going to be very emboldened to just make assertions on things they don't like. And it can be politicized. It can be kind of progressive in the sense of we are reacting rhetorically to a protected class of customers that we want to act on their behalf. So I think that it would be a huge impact for antitrust law for decades to come if the government wins cleanly, because they just didn't prove anything. They didn't prove anything. They didn't fail to prove anything. They didn't act like they needed to. They have a theory. Okay, theory. You can say it with a straight face. Better theory than some of the recent ones they've tried. But I think it's a pretty weak case. I think I feel much better about this just in a clean room. What would you decide given this set of facts? I mean, I think that that's... I was going to say 90%. No, it's literally 100%. I would side with the companies, and that's not an advocacy view. That's I don't believe the government proved their case. I don't believe that they proved that there was harm. I mean, you might, for the sake of a decision, stipulate enough harm to construct a divestiture package. But I think there's some shot that you would actually have a blowout for the companies that would even undermine the divestiture package that they proposed. If there's not harm proven, I mean, you probabilistically are saving yourself time and money by responding to a potential harm in offering a divestiture package. But if a judge says there wasn't harm, the companies could pull their divestiture offer. I think I would accept their offer. You could expand it. But there's lots of kind of nuanced middling grounds that this judge could pick. But I think the companies gave him far more language that he could use in a decision than the government did. The government, rightly or wrongly, and I'm a little spooked by this, seems supremely confident. They don't need to budge an inch on anything.
I just, the things that, in just reviewing all my notes and reviewing a lot of the transcripts, the things that jump out to me is, as you said, the government seems supremely confident. And I just think back to the start of the trial when I think it was JetBlue CEO said, hey, look, like, this divestiture package that we put together, on our own with no input from the government. Like, the government wouldn't even talk divestiture package, which seems so crazy to me. And then, you know, I keep thinking about the government in both their closing trial briefs and even in response. There's this little, I can't remember the exact word for it, but after the closing trial briefs are filed, the Illumina decision comes out, which I think has very good language for JetBlue. And JetBlue files, I guess it's like a post trial brief or something, saying, hey, court, look at this Illumina decision. This is pretty good for us. And the government files a response that's like taking all the Illumina decision's words completely out of context or like skipping through. And I keep thinking about that. And then they grafted in their post closing trial brief, they grafted two different cases together to get a standard that neither of the cases suggested. Keep looking at that and be like, the government, they seem not to care. They seem not to care about rules or law. It's just like really weird to me. And I keep getting concerned. You mentioned price. Like, maybe I'm just seeing my own shadow, but I do worry if, again, judges only have antitrust cases in front of them maybe once in their career. This is an 80-year-old judge who, I think this is the second antitrust case that's been in front of him. And I just keep worrying about, hey, JetBlue is going to raise Spirit's like headline prices, right? Because they offered a bundled offering and they're going to raise Spirit's headline prices. I just keep worrying about a judge seeing prices up, antitrust issue, and ruling against this. But I'm with you. Like, when I review the facts of the case, I don't think there's been really any harm proven. Maybe there would have been harm at the divestiture gates, but those are getting divested. So I just don't know. And like, I'm trying to be, I don't know, humble, because the market, it's come up recently, obviously, but the market's got this price at kind of, I would say 40% for JetBlue, 60% for the government. I'm trying to be humble because when I read the facts of the case, I'm like 95% for JetBlue. When I like kind of think about the some of the judges' commentary on pricing going up, I'm like, okay, maybe 70%, but the judge seems very much to want to make a ruling with divestitures. I think that's where he's leaning. But yeah, I'm just trying to be humble. But as you said, if they block this, I mean, who knows where it stops? JetBlue even makes the point, hey, you're basically allowing the government to choose protected classes of business, right? Like, hey, chain X wants to go buy 15 store chain discount grocer. That's a block because that's a discount grocer. That's a protected business. Like, I can easily see that.
All of the elements of a flight have to get passed on to the consumers one way or another. And anything you improve will have costs. Anything that you slacken will have less costs. And it's up to the free market and the free market participants to make that choice. Transferring that choice to the government and this kind of fourth branch of government, the administrative state, and kind of putting them in charge of business models would be a huge change to our system. And saying it's a ratchet effect that if you ever do something, you may not raise prices as a result of a transaction. You could think of all sorts of perverse consequences. What if a airline was discounted because of lax safety standards, separate from any kind of regulatory issue? They just hired pilots that were only moderately successful in sobriety, maybe in some ways that avoided a specific regulatory status. They were just tipsy. But if you were willing to hire tipsy pilots, you could get them at a discount. It was a very low ticket price. And then the buyers came in and said, we're going to have safer commercial air travel, and we're going to hire more sober pilots. But these sober guys, they want to get paid 5% more. The other airlines want to hire them, and people that have tighter standards for drunkenness in the cockpit will hire them, and we have to raise the ticket price by 5%. The government say, no, you can't do that. We have sanctified whatever business model has the lowest nominal price. The tipsy airline has to maintain their practice of hiring only marginally sober pilots. I mean, that's just absurd, but that absurdity is what this would open up to.
It's a great point. Or, you think about a hotel chain. Hey, like this other company's got great hotel, like great location hotels, but we think their service is substandard. Like, we think if we bought them and we improved the service, maybe refresh the rooms, we could increase the prices and increase our economic profits. And the government comes in and says, oh no, absolutely not. Like, these hotels need to be run like, basically slum hotels, because people want the cheapest possible stay. It's like, well, actually, like, the free market should dictate that. And yeah, I'm with you. I really like that analysis.
People don't really get is these are very intelligent people and probably sincere people. They're very good at sort of mechanistically looking at, if you think about the work that we do on antitrust, a lot of it is looking at comps. A lot of it is kind of very convergent on a view that is sort of based on things that have happened in the past. That's how they used to thinking. A lot of these businessmen don't necessarily want to say this, but they're winging it. They're guessing. They're trying to make plausible guesses, but they're kind of cold reading the market saying, I don't know what these people want. I have some guesses. And then they try Spirit. And then it turns out, cold reading this market, Spirit is not what people profitably want as a business model right now. So they're switching to JetBlue because the wild ass guess of Spirit was less good than the wild ass guess of JetBlue. And so that's kind of how markets work. It's very sort of sloppy and chaotic up front, probably very foreign to the government people who are not sloppy and chaotic. And these businessmen, who sometimes say in hot documents they think or they're planning, they're just saying stuff. They're just trying, and they're largely going to make a decent guess and then be right or wrong, and then try to be nimble and pivot quickly and not destroy themselves when they're wrong. So pivoting when they're wrong is a lot of what they do. It's a little humbling and embarrassing, and I don't think they want to be under oath explaining how much that's the reality. But I think it's a huge part of the reality, and that they kind of converge on more or less what people want. And a lot of it's just operating quickly. So something like the gates is really important to antitrust because it not just potentially protects incumbents, not just could be an antitrust problem, but it's sort of this friction on this process of reacting to mistakes, wherein airplanes generally, other than the gate restrictions, can do so within weeks. That's why I think one of the key parts of this trial, especially if JetBlue and Spirit win, the whole real world commentary from the other ULCCs, which I want to say was 100% favoring the deal or close to it. I mean, the government had almost no real world. Some guy said, yeah, I'm the CEO of this airline and I'm going to come in and I'm going to take profitable demand-driven routes that these guys exit within weeks. I mean, within maybe within a few hours that it takes the plane to fly there. And so I think that that side really favored the deal, really favored approval, and really was kind of indicative of how actual markets work.
I mentioned this on the Lionel pod, but this is one of the things I said. It was like, look, in order to rule for the government, the government's case basically had to be like, ignore every industry witness who testified and rule for us, right? Like the United CEO said, we're bringing lots of basics on. The Frontier CEO said, as soon as Spirit exits these profitable routes, once this merger comes through, it's going to be a feeding frenzy and we're going to take over all of them. Like you have to ignore every witness and be like, hey, every credible witness was lying to you and you have to believe this theory of harm, which again, I don't really think they proved harm. Let me switch gears real quick. Another popular question we got was just, hey, ask Chris about what his views of 2024 are and maybe any lessons he learned in 2023. So I'll just toss that one out at you.
It's been a weak year for M&A, kind of volume in terms of deals and dollars generally. I think that the interest rate fluctuations, deals can handle high rates, low rates, medium rates, but you just need kind of stability for a few months. And when things are changing rapidly, that makes it a little harder.
Yeah, and if you're about to take $1 billion loan out and interest rates are 3% and then they're 5%, it's like, well, okay, that's an extra, you know, $20 million per year or whatever that we're going to have to pay in interest expense. Like that really changes the math on your deal. And you might've been talking about a $2 billion valuation, that $20 million per year changes it to 1.7. And, you know, it just kind of freezes everything because the numbers are changing.
Yeah. And in theory, the price system should be able to take that into account. In practice, the kind of psychological heuristics that real world management and boards use that tend to be a little self-serving and have, it just increases the bid ask spread on deal prices. You know, that you can, there's a few different ways to look at it. Everybody looks at it the most self-serving way and makes it just harder to transact. I think one of the funny things about this year is how several times old saw views on financials were kind of backwards in terms of what world is good for banks, bad for banks. A couple times seems like the market has kind of said new things, thought new things about what banking is after the bank blowups that were fairly one off, or the biggest problems were not indicative of what most institutions were doing. But now that that's settled down to some extent, I think you could have, I'm almost embarrassed to say, we could have more bank and thrift mergers, because I always think that, and then it's been very, very low for a while. But I think we could have more bank and thrift mergers. I think we could have a particular transaction that looks the most arithmetically obvious to me that you can just solve for, that we could have hundreds or at least dozens if people think about it the same way I do, which is demutualizations has always been a huge interest of mine. I happen to have one this morning where you take a private institution and then typically a two-step, go through a mutual hold co, then sell the whole thing to public investors, can be lucrative for depositors, can be interesting. But a lot of these very small financial institutions that for years and years and years, these transactions have gone well, we've had kind of no market a demand for them after they were in public, traded down in many cases, and kind of have these orphaned mutual holdcos. Well, the easiest math is to remutualize them. They're halfway out to the public market. Just bring them back to the private market. You don't have to pay any kind of premium for a majority of the shares. So the dollar figures are tiny that you have to put to work to take them back to becoming fully mutual. You can pay these huge premiums for the public equity, the equity of public holders that are now public, and get them for basically for free. If you look at just the remarking the portfolio after a deal, the arithmetic on the remutualization seems like you could kind of take all of them fully private again, remutualize all the ones that the market decided that they don't like and are trading a big discounts to their tangible book value. So I think that if I was a banker, if I was going around trying to advocate for transactions, I mean, that's one that you could just pull in a whole industry on something that's almost a cinch. Financials generally, biotech. I think the second most interesting thing besides remutualization is the broken biotech activism driven deals where you're saying, hey, if the market only wants to pay you 50 cents a dollar for your cash, I'll pay you 75 cents. And if you think, no, I shouldn't take 75 cents because of fortune, honor, and glory that I'll have in the future that nobody gives me any credit for, including the regulators, including the market, well, guess what? I'll just give you whatever you get after that. Here's a CVR. And that just seems like a perpetual emotion machine. If you can get past the, entrenchment of the board management. So I think there should be a lot of biotech deals, a lot of CBRs, a lot of activism there. And so those are two areas that are specifically interesting for me, but hopefully just generally a lot more deals.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, just on the CBR, we've kind of mentioned these, but you know, it's going into like just last week there was, what was it? Theseus. This is really small and the deal's already been announced, but the ticker there is THRX. I think we do have a tiny position in it just for the disclosure, but yep. That was one where failed drug, trading below cash. I think they got multiple offers and ran like a mini process or something, if I'm kind of reading the tea leaves correctly, but they did exactly what you're saying. We're selling for cash plus you get a CVR for any proceeds we get. And yeah, it's just, you know, you look at some of these and like, I haven't followed it as close. I don't want to call specific one. I will just say like, you look at some of them and they've traded below cash for years. And you know, the issue is, if you're below 100 million, you've got all this cash on the balance sheets. Like by the time somebody runs a process on you to remove the board and get you to do something shareholder friendly, if you're not inclined to, like you've burnt so much of the cash that it's almost not even worth it. So you get these companies, and I've seen several where they take a shot, it misses. They plow, you know, of their 100 million, they plow 70 million into a new shot that misses. But guess what? They've paid themselves 6 million in salary along the way. Now they've got 30 million. They find a new shot or they do, and it can just become this perpetual motion machine of value destruction. And it's so sad to me. My heart bleeds every time there's a company trading for 50 million with 100 million in net cash. And they say, hey, you know what? We know better than the market. We're going to go try and buy some new drugs and do something. Like, oh, just return it to shareholders. Create the value. Create all the value.
Two reading assignments for people listening and interested in this topic and event investing generally for this next year that I think are really elucidating. And then one regulatory/court good governance change that I would do. Bouncing back to the antitrust case recently, and then I'll tie this into biotech. Whenever somebody tries to quote something, always take the time just to read the whole context, at least the several paragraphs before and after, just to make sure that they're saying what they really said and didn't take something out of context, and make sure that you can trust the credibility of the quoter that in the case of Spirit, I think really hurts the credibility of the government using sophistry. They're just using rhetorical kind of junior high school debating tricks to say things that were not meant by the precedents, that were meant by them. They just have this theory and they're trying to put it in the mouths of other judges in the past that did not say what they said. And then in the case of the biotech deals, I tend to find fairness opinions by financial advisors to be hot garbage, almost worth. I mean, I read them, but I think, boy, like it's amazing how much money these guys get if that's really the work they do. But the background section is always fascinating. And it's particularly fascinating when there's a CVR, because a CVR is largely a placeholding mechanism for negotiation where say, hey, look, it's not better than X, it's better than Y. Can we just set that aside? Usually you can split the difference and just pay cash or stock. But every once in a while, there's something that truly is unknown at the time of the transaction. So it lets you just kind of defer that information to later and then have the price accordingly. But the CVR background section is fascinating to see who was pushing, because there's a couple different versions of this that once they play out, you look back in hindsight and think, oh, that was almost certainly going to get paid, or far more frequently, almost certainly not going to get paid in something where you have probably the biggest agency problem in all of the capital markets, which is you are being managed by the people who are supposed to pay you. And that has been bad. And if you think about kind of Charlie Munger and incentives, as much as I think about that and worry about that, I understated how bad that was, even though I would have that as a caveat to any CVR I've ever owned. It's a bigger deal than, but you look at the background section and sometimes it's something that is advocated by the people getting paid and they say, look, we think this is going to happen. We're selling it to you, but we think it's going to be really good. And that it's more or less their version in a highly competitive process with lots of bidders and one bidder pays it. Or other times, and this was a crushing mistake on my part, but one where the buyer failed on something. And when they failed, they were like, told ya, we never thought you were going to get that manufacturing thing up in time. We thought you were crazy. You were super optimistic. See, we're paying you nothing. And if you listen to their tone in that, it was kind of a calling the bluff of a deal target CVR. And sometimes you need to talk to them. Sometimes it's not clear until too late, but sometimes it kind of comes out in the background section, kind of who proposed what the bid and ask spread was, what was the nature of the CVR. And if you really understand that, you can get a much better perception in terms of what it's worth.
And now a quick break to remind you that this episode is brought to you exclusively by AlphaSense, the AI platform behind the world's biggest investment decisions. AlphaSense gives you the tools you need to provide better analysis for you and your clients. As yet another Value Podcast listener, visit alpha-sense.com/FS today to beat FOMO and move faster than the market. That's alpha-sense.com/FS.
You know what it reminds me of? There's been this argument between, I think it's Shell and a US LNG supplier, right? And they had an agreement and was, hey, as soon as the LNG is online for commercialization, we'll buy the LNG from you at $5 for LNG or whatever, right? And the LNG was coming from the US to Europe. And the supplier, the plant came online, but you know, European nat gas prices were 100, not five. So the supplier said, hey, the plant isn't fully commercialized. And the agreement said we sell once it's fully commercialized. So the supplier was taking all this LNG and selling it at $100 in the spot market. And Chevron, Shell, everybody said, we have an agreement for $5. I rambled a lot. But so the basics is, nat gas prices went crazy in Europe. This company had a contract to sell for $5 for LNG and they said, hey, we're not fully commercial yet. So we're going to go sell in the spot market for $100. And Shell and all these guys were like, wait, you're selling all the LNG, but you're just saying you're not fully commercial yet. And Matt Levine had a funny point where he was like, look, the company should like not paint the last rivet until the moment that the spot contract is below what their fixed price is. And then they should paint the last rivet and say, all right, contract's on. But CVRs in many ways remind me of that, right? Like you've got the people, you're selling to them, and then they completely determine when they pay you out. And like we've seen over and over and over again, the one I know the other one you're thinking of, but the one I'm thinking of is the Bristol-Myers Squibb CVR, where it got to, because of some COVID delays, it should have been approved by the whole thing timed out at the end of 2020. If it wasn't for COVID, everything would have been approved by 2019. There would have been no rush, right? Like getting a drug on the market a year earlier is completely worth paying the CVR out. But because of COVID delays, Bristol-Myers, if they could just push approval by 1 or 2 weeks, they could avoid about $6 billion worth of CVR payments. And, in my opinion, based on everything I've seen, I think there's a court case that will decide if this is true or not. But in my opinion, they pushed approval by a couple weeks just so they didn't have to pay this $6 billion CVR completely inside of their incentives. But, again, when the counter is the person who's also paying you, it can create some pretty perverse incentives and pretty perverse outcomes. And that's just one example. And again, there are dozens of others with CVRs, which is why one of the reasons I think these things get discounted so heavily. I do think they're an interesting area, but they can be tough.
I think I've mentioned on this podcast before, one reform I'd love to see in corporate transactions would be a buyback line as an alternative to every buyer proxy on every M&A. Because it stipulates when I say, hey, I'm going to pay 40% premium for this other company, that I have that much flexibility with my balance sheet to pay cash. It's that good a deal to pay stock. But every shareholder of a buyer should get to say, yes, I agree that strategically that deal is so wildly valuable that it's better than paying me a premium for my stock that I already own that you can do conveniently. And as an ARB, I think that would, M&A volume would go down by 90% if that was reality, but I think it would be a good reform. My equivalent in biotech should be, hey, I'd like to raise all this equity capital from you. I have this specific thing I'm planning on doing, but every subsequent year when you're going to reelect the board, there's a liquidation line in the proxy. Hey, do you want your money money back. Key line being yours.
Another great
thing. This thing, but if I'm wrong, you get it back.
Closed-end funds would be another great place for that, right? Mm-hmm. I know we probably have underdone closed-end funds, but yeah. That's a great one. Hey, we've got this. I love every time somebody goes activist on a closed-end fund, and the closed-end fund comes out and says, hey, don't let these short-term activists take away from the long-term value of your shares. It's like, hey, guys, you own like Apple and NVIDIA. You own $100 million worth of them, and your stock trades for $90 million. Like, what are you talking about? Liquidate this damn thing. Like, the only reason you want to keep it going is because you want that gravy train of fees to keep rolling. But I'm with you on the M&A. Like, I'll talk to companies all the time, and I'll be like, hey, you know, you trade for 5x EBITDA, right? And they'll be like, yeah, and we can't wait. We're going to go out. We're going to buy people. We're going to buy them for 6x EBITDA. It's going to be great. I'll be like, okay, let's stop. Like, why are you going out and buying companies for 6x EBITDA? Why is that creating value versus buying your own stock for 5x EBITDA? And a lot of times they'll pause, and obviously there's sin, like blah, blah, blah. But a lot of times they'll pause and they'll be like, well, we don't buy back stock. We're a growth company. I'd be like, okay, but let's talk from a share. Like, what would shareholders be better at? Would we be better if you were buying back stock, or if you were going and buying out these companies? And a lot of times it's like drool coming out of their mouth on the other end. It's like, they just don't understand why I'm not so excited about them going and buying companies for multiples above where they trade. Or, you know, you can apply it to a lot of the fiber companies these days. They're like, hey, we're going to go out, we're going to build fiber at, you know, $2,500 for homes passed to grow the company. Be like, okay, cool. But your stock trades for $1,800 per home passed. So how is, like, just walk me through the math of how it's a better investment to go build new fiber versus buy your stock back. And maybe it is, but just like walk me through that math. And very few of them can. So anyway, any last thoughts?
The amount of demonstrable skill in corporate transactions justifying premiums is pretty hard to find. It's in very specific situations, and it's very, very rare. The most hard to justify one, and I think I won't say the name, but founder CEO management-led buyout effort where a very highly compensated person for a very small company has been trying to buy out the minority investors at a discount to tangible book value. And so I'm looking at that situation saying, man, you've taken a pile of assets and you make it worth less alive than dead. You'd like to pay a price less alive than dead. And you want to get paid millions and millions of dollars every year for the role since its beginning in making it worth less alive than dead. How can all those things be true? Either you should get a 90% pay cut, or you should get a massive increase to what you're offering, but it can't both be right. And I think that part of the fun of my reforms, but the reason why it'll never happen, is it's just too revealing in the lack of skill in corporate transactions. They're not paying 40% premiums and then creating something worth the 60% premium. They're largely destroying value.
Any last thoughts for 2024 or anything else you want to talk about?
More deals, especially biotech and financials, and hopefully some good outcomes in a handful of antitrust things. And then I think we'll know more about Spirit next, and then that will have big ramifications in terms of how we think about Albertsons and iRobot and others.
Cool. Okay, well, hey, Chris. Again, the one rule for 2024, forget M&A, you and I, between my arm and your knee, yeah. No more injuries for 2024. When we're doing this in 12 months, we're going to be the healthiest, fittest people on earth. You're going to be climbing mountains again. I'm going to be squatting big numbers, and we're going to go from there.
I hope so. Great talking with you, Andrew.
All right. Bye, Chris.
A quick disclaimer. Nothing on this podcast should be considered investment advice. Guests or the hosts may have positions in any of the stocks mentioned during this podcast. Please do your own work and consult a financial advisor. Thanks.